The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Time for our sports books of the year. We do this every year. I'm delighted Niamh Briggs, the Ireland international rugby player, is back with us again this year and joined this year by Sunday Times sports writer Michael Foley. Okay, Niamh, you went for a golf book as one of your picks, Tiger Woods.
Yeah, it was, I suppose, we're all very, you know, he has that aura of invincibility about him, and before the whole crash, I suppose.
Crash is one way of putting it, but there was a car crash,
yeah,
was part
definitely.
Of it.
there was just this, you know, stoic, don't get too close to me, I don't have any emotion type of thing. And I found this book to be very interesting. Because
this is Jeff Benedict and Armen Keaton. Is this an approved biography, or is this a sort of a
they basically went to everybody he was close to, trawled through thousands of articles, books written about him, the whole thing together, and put together this book about his life without him writing it, I suppose. And I found it very, have you read it? I thought it was really good.
No.
What it does is very clear to see why he was so like he was, because
a lot of it down to his father as well.
Upbringing and the pressure that he was put under as a child. Not that I'm condoning his behaviour or anything like that, but I just thought it was very interesting.
His behaviour, does it come across that it was a reaction to sort of the controlling way of his father, Errol?
Basically what he grew up with, his father was very controlling, had a lot of extramarital affairs. The marriage itself was shambles. He lived in one house, his mother lived in another. And he had no childhood as such. And I just found it to be very interesting, something different. It was just a different sports book, I suppose.
You know, there's so many sports books we get to my list that are about dysfunction, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, even in childhood or adulthood, and an awful lot of the key characters in the books we're going to review this year.
Well, it's an interesting thing about sports books. It's probably another conversation in a way, but like the notion that where does sport and the kind of the externalities of life then, where do they intersect, and what weight do you put from one to the other? Because what you have, like, I mean, you know, it's interesting you should mention about his dad, the influence of his dad. I mean, you know, we'll probably talk about Eamon McGee's book in a wee while, and I mean, the impact of environment and family there as well is just immense. Where you start talking about where how you balance the sport against the life aspect. I mean, for 20-odd years now, we've kind of had this gradual shift in Irish sports writing and books particularly, of sort of, you know, human stories. Whereas if you go back 20 years ago, the sports book was basically probably about a great player, whether it was a rugby player, soccer
and
player,
sort of chronologically going through the matches, yeah, that they played in,
and
or whatever.
And it probably, by the end of it, you probably thought they were an even better fella than you thought in the first place. Whereas now you're picking up sports books and it's magnifying the player, but in a different way. It's magnifying the cracks in this person.
The flaws
and all that.
The adversity they had to overcome, the depression, yeah, that follows defeat, all that
and
sort
as
of
opposed
stuff.
To sort of,
there were so many of them like that. We were only speaking about it outside, about, yeah, how strong the category was this year, yeah, in terms of the books being, yeah, way better written. Yeah. They were just, the story itself behind, very few of them now are talking about the matches, the games.
But this is the thing, right? And here's like, I've always been strong on the idea, and you know, it's a bit of a cliche that, you know, sport is only a hook for bigger stories about life and so on and so forth. But the thing that strikes me now is that, where are we in this? Are we going almost too far the other way now?
Because
where is the sports story?
Well, actually, The Lost Soul of Eamon McGee, let's talk about that, written by Paul Gibson, right? There's boxing in it, but this isn't a boxing book. It's not a sports book. This is a story of criminality and God knows what. Tell us a bit of what's
well,
in it.
Well, it's an extraordinary story. I mean, if anybody has ever come across the Eamon McGee story, they will know that this, you know, you talk about autobiographies, this is certainly a life story that needed to be written, whatever category you put it into. Eamon McGee, he was a world champion boxer who grew up in the Ardoyne in North Belfast through the height of the Troubles, and was an active, you know, an active player in the way that kids around in those areas were. You ask, is it a sports book? I threw this around in my head when I was reading it in the last while, and I think it definitely is a sports book. I think that, but it's also, it's a lot of other things. I think it's an important social document. I think it's also something that when you read it, it gives you an insight into the impact that something like the Troubles has, not just on Eamon McGee, but on his family, on an entire environment, and how that can play forward through the generations. I mean, you know, Eamon McGee is still living with the impact of an awful lot of things that happened in his childhood. Like, his father was very active in the Republican movement. His father was then told to get out of Belfast by the IRA, but didn't get out of Belfast. He lived in the attic for the duration of time that he was meant to be gone. And when they said, oh, you can come back again, he just effectively just walked out the front door for the first time. I think it was 9.5 months or something like that. When Eamon McGee is asked about that in the book, he effectively breaks down.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, you're painting him as a victim rather than taking responsibility for his own actions.
And I don't mean to
do
that.
You're excusing it, perhaps.
No, I will wholly reject that theory on the basis that Eamon McGee, I would have no sympathy for Eamon McGee in the totality of the book. It's a very hard book. It's a very dark book. It's an extremely violent book. And when you're reading it, you're going through it, and how would you put it? You're so wrapped up in the violence of it that, but by the same token, you're not seeing any sort of regret or sort of...
You're intriguing me about it. I must read it. Okay,
I've not read it either.
Well, the one thing I would say about it before, if we're moving on or whatever, the one thing I would say about it is that there are parts of the book where it is slightly overwritten. And this is a story, and I mean, you know, it's a great old adage that I was told a long time ago, and I don't always kind of abide by it, but I think everybody should. If you've got a good story to tell, get the hell out of the way of it. And Eamon McGee's story is absolutely fantastic, and it's one sports book of the year. I wouldn't have it as my sports book of the year, but it is a terrific story.
Okay, what's your next pick?
A couple of GA books, I suppose. Cora Staunton's, Dave Fitzgerald's, both very well written. I was very surprised about David Fitzgerald's, to be honest. I'm a big Vincent Hogan fan, so
Work when he's done some fantastic ghostwriting work
and
as well.
The one thing that stuck out for me is, like, look, his persona on the pitch, he comes across as madman. He speaks about it clearly in his book that, you know, it's usually to get a reaction from his own players. And yes, he does cross the line. He was, you know, very, like, he stated it very clearly, but loyalty and integrity are huge to him.
He's a big man to hold a grudge. And I'm not saying this, and I've said it to his face when he was in here a few weeks ago. He's a good man to hold a grudge.
Well, this is like, this is where this kind of notion, this loyalty and integrity are huge. Like, he comes across as that they're very, very important to him. He feels that the Clare people, the hurling community didn't give him that backing, weren't loyal to him, and, you know, he's very strong
what he did for them, both as a player and as a manager.
Yeah, and I can totally see it from his point. And, you know, he is mad 100%. But it was actually a very well written book.
I've flaked through it, and I'm going to go back for a proper look at it. The thing about Davy Fitz that you would always feel about his style of management is that it has. It's very intense. So it's very intense for the other side as well. So there's only a certain amount. I think there's a limited shelf life for Davy with any team.
Okay, Cora Staunton is also a very intense woman. And that comes across in the book. But also there's really some really interesting personal stories. And it gives a really good flavour of why she is as she is.
People's perceptions of her are somebody that, you know, can win at all costs and doesn't care about anything else apart from it. And it wasn't that at all. You know, she basically gave up school for a year to care for her mum and to look after the family home.
And her mother died when she was still a teenager.
And, you know, it's incredibly sad and very well told. And like Mary White wrote that, and she also wrote that book in Cork, Footballers Relentless. And I enjoy how she writes. And I didn't put that down. I read that in one sitting and it was good. Look, I think when the book came out, there was obviously the whole issue about surrounding her in Mayo football, and people kind of forget what she's done for, you know, she's broken glass ceilings in terms of women's sport. Herself and Katie Taylor are probably two of the most well-known female sports stars in Ireland. And I thought it was a good book.
That could be the problem sometimes with books like that, you know, when you've got a kind of an ongoing issue like the Carnacon issue, that it can sometimes sort of, you know, oh, we've got to get it. Chapter on that into the end of it there, you know, and it kind of overwhelms the rest of it. Slightly, the one thing about Cora, I think I take what Niamh is saying, but I think in terms of when she's on the field, it is relentless. Like,
it and has it is, to be
and
at it, that level.
And she's absolutely like unrepentant about the way yeah. she would speak to people and so on and so forth. The one thing, again, that I would have loved to have read in the Cora book, and I think it goes back to what we all look for in sports books, is that, you know, as kind of average Joes like you and me, Matt, you know, we look at Niamh and the likes of these elite sports people. We want to know, why are they elite sports people? What makes you elite, right? You read the Cora book, and it's kind of assumed through the whole book that, well, we all know she's brilliant. But I would have loved to have read kind of, you know, little pieces with maybe her coaches and with teammates. And
it kind of touches on it, though, in a little bit, in terms of when she kind of speaks about it herself, in that, yeah. you know, she sets standards. She yeah. doesn't mind giving anybody a rollicking on the pitch, knowing that they're going to be better for it.
But I'd love to know how the one who got the rollicking felt about getting the rollicking.
Well, majority of the time they don't like it.
Niamh, there's one more GA one, which I certainly really enjoyed. And we had Sean Kavanagh in for interview, obsessed, and he really is obsessed.
Oh my God, the obsession. Yeah, how appropriately named. Like, I couldn't get over it. I think
worryingly so towards the end of his career. That
definitely.
Actually came across as like, hang on a second, this actually went beyond the beyonds.
Without giving too much away, like he loses the match they lost and he goes missing almost for
wandering the fields of Tyrone in the middle of the night.
It was completely and utterly it made me sit up and think, like, this is an amateur sport. They don't get paid. This is, you know, such a cultural thing, the GAA. Yeah. They want to go out and they want to win, and how important it is for them and their family. But, like, to the extreme that, you know, it's your be all and end all. I was very surprised. And yeah. I suppose that's probably what made him as good as he is. But, you know, I'd love to know what he's like now in terms of how has he filled that void, you know, that's left behind, you know, in terms of
the mental anguish, which helps.
Well, the mental anguish that he went through. I couldn't, but it was very interesting. So many like little things, you know, his family life, you know, the troubles, like his relationship with Mickey Hart. I just thought it was all right. It's a very good book.
Was the cabinet, when he went walkabout, was that after the All-Ireland semi-final last year against Dublin?
The year before,
Like 2017. Because I met him self and the brother 10 days before that game, and you could tell like that this was, because this is going to be
Was it the 2016 loss to Mayo? The quarterfinal loss
to Mayo. Yeah, to Mayo, sorry.
Okay, well.
But they just dropped him in the village and he walked.
Yeah, he spoke a bit about it, and like, last year, obviously, 2017 was his last year, and you could see the sort of, you know, he wanted to go out on a high. But I mean, I interviewed him four times down the years, and I mean, what always struck me about him was that, it says it on the front of the book, he's obsessive nature. I mean, physically, the man is in ribbons. I mean, I was saying to you outside, like, they've written TCs on his shoulders. His shoulders are so badly damaged over the years that TCs have been written on it, on these particular injuries. Like, he always had that sort of zone in focus on what he wanted, and he was always very, very driven in terms of what he wanted to do.
The top players, those people that are driven by that, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's also what exacerbated the rift with Mickey Hart, and because you had two guys with the exact same outlook in that regard, you know, clashing, so it spreads, you know, it splits them even more.
There's one more GAA book I want to take, which is entirely different, and this is Neil Cotter's book on Dublin, The Chaos Years. This period when they won an All-Ireland in 95 and didn't win another one till 2011.
Yeah, these are the ones I go for when it comes to GAA books, if they're out there at all. Like, there's plenty of autobiographies, but I think it's always worth giving a mention to these kind of ones. Neil's basically gone back and he's looked at that period, like you say, Matt, from 96 to 2011 and gone, okay, what happened to Dublin in that period?
Because of all the resources, all the players, all the population, all the things that we're saying now that made Dublin unbeatable.
Yeah, well, they did and they didn't, in the sense that they weren't organised. I mean, it was a situation where Dublin that time was pretty much like pretty much every other county in Ireland in terms of how they use their resources. But there are some extraordinary, I mean, if candor is measured in terms of how many swear words you can get into a book, this one is the most candid book you'll read all year. It's just so raw and so straight talking. I mean, Keith Barr comes out as one of the stars of the first half of the book, because he just gives it as it is. He's kind of essentially saying, I mean, you get a real sense of why Dublin didn't work in that period. Basically, there was just too many cliques.
Was it a cultural thing?
It was a cultural thing, but it was a cultural thing also because of the knockout system that prevailed in the championship at the time. So you had a lot of guys who had soldiered for years to get this jersey, and there was no way in hell they were going to go over and shake the hand of the young fella coming in. I mean, Keith Barr says it himself in the book. He said he had three friends in that dressing room: Keith Barr, Keith Barr, and Keith Barr. And that was part of the kind of, that was part of, in a way, that was part of what made Dublin really strong at the time in one regard, but also it weakened them over the long term. And as you go through the book, and he speaks to people through the era, Tommy Carr was manager, Tommy Lyons, and on up into the noughties, into the blue book, which was kind of their design for life, if you like, in terms of winning All-Irelands and going on. Kind of they had this kind of tradition for a year where they marched to the hill. They injected a bit extra trash talking into it. One of the players says he was criticised for not getting enough yellow cards one year, which is kind of seen as a kind of, yeah, you're not being tough enough, you know, this kind of stuff. It was almost like they were trying to regain what makes the Dubs, but it was a misreading of what makes the Dubs. What we're seeing now, and take away all the money and all the rest of it, just how that team prepares and their outlook and their attitude and how they apply themselves to their work. That's what always made the Dubs. They go the extra mile. They go, they kind of look up and out for how can we get better. They don't look in on themselves and say, well, we were good before, you know. But it's a raw read, but it's good.
Now, it's a book that both of you have picked, and I'm going to start with you, Niamh, on this one. Rosemary Smith's book, Driven. Now,
yeah.
Had you heard of Rosemary Smith before you picked up
just
this book?
Just fleetingly, as you know, your sports person that, like, whatever, you just love it, but nothing about her life. I knew nothing about her, to be honest.
And okay, so just to hear, because she was a rally driver. Yeah. She was Ireland's first female rally driver.
She talk about people breaking down glass ceilings. Yeah, she amazing. Absolutely did. And it was brilliant. It was how she had to, in a male-dominated sport, had to make herself, you know, be seen. And
competing against them, because it's one of the few sports where men and women compete together.
Yeah, yeah. Like, she tells really funny stories. Like, I actually thought it was quite a humorous book. It was very good. Like, she obviously had a lot of adversity, you know, and her marriage and stuff was all, like, didn't go right. But, like, she tells stories, like, where parts of the engine are broken and, like, she decides to reverse up a hill.
Well, the Khyber Pass.
And, like, it's just a hill.
No, it is a hill. It is a hill. But it's not just a hill.
It's just, like, literally, like, her ability to think on her feet, I thought, was something.
I mean, even the co-drivers. I mean, at one stage, I think the co-driver, there was a problem with the accelerator or something. The co-driver had to hang out the passenger window and kind of keep the button pressed on the accelerator as they're going at full tilt. I mean, some of the accidents and stuff like that as well, you're kind of going, how is this woman still alive?
I know, yeah.
But, like, it was the kind of book, I was reading it along, and I mean, I wouldn't be really into cars at all and racing, nothing. It would leave me cold now, to be honest. Traffic, as far as I'm concerned. But I was reading it away, and you're kind of lolling along and you're reading, and the next thing, you're like, all right, she's having a drink now with who? Oliver Reed. Okay, and now she's in Jimmy Scott's jazz club in the height of the 60s.
Yeah,
and now she's, you know, she's driving across Afghanistan and then down into Australia and down into Saudi Arabia. And you're like, well, this is, I mean, again, I go back, as I said about Eamon McGee's book, if ever there's, like, a life that needs to be put into a book, this was it.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant.
There's just some great old stories.
Really good stories.
It's a real storybook.
Yeah,
but
really,
it's interesting that it's only happening now, because, I mean, I remember as a child being familiar with her. She was a star in the 1970s when I was a child.
Yeah. I mean, I would have come across her just professionally, I suppose, as a female sports person. It's not even talking about, you're not even talking about glass ceilings here. You're talking about, like, I don't know, like the cube. You know, you're smashing the cube. It's not a glass ceiling. So I would have come across
that
it that way.
That would be one of my recommendations from this year. I think even if you're not into sport, just for her life
sports,
alone.
Yeah, or motorsports, because I'd be like, Michael, I'm not into cars.
Clue, like, but even in terms of,
but she used to drive a Hillman Imp everywhere, which was like, I was kind of going, God, I remember hearing words of, I remember hearing Hillman back when I was young, like, and I wasn't a great car, like, but she, it's a great read. It's but I think more so in the context of what we're talking about now about women's sport in the 21st century. And what I found interesting was, I mean, she says it herself in the book, she was essentially seen as a dolly bird, and she was employed as a dolly bird a lot of the time. And a part of her knew she had to do that to do what she wanted to do in sport at that time. And you kind of go, well, you know what? She had to do that to make those breaks for people. And I better
clarify that you use the expression dolly bird as being of its time.
Of its
era,
time.
Rather than being something that
I'm sitting
in the 21st century description that you would make of a woman.
I'm sitting now, in my mind, I'm sitting in Jimmy Scott's jazz club with Rosemary on the left and Oliver Reed on my right. And we're just, you know, we're just grooving.
More sports books of the year to recommend. Again, I'm not sure this is entirely a sports book, but it definitely is one of the reads of the year. And we've done an awful lot, not just when we interviewed Declan Lynch and Tony O'Reilly about Tony Ten, but we've done an awful lot about the prevalence of gambling advertising this year on the programme. Why did you pick this, Michael?
Oh, well, for me, this is the sports book of the year. And I know what you're, you know, it goes, as you say, it goes back to the conversation of what's a sports book. But I think that gambling now is so prevalent in sport. It is so intrinsic.
It's all pervasive.
It's appalling. It is absolutely appalling. And, you know, a lot of the time sports books are a reflection of what's going on outside in the real world. And okay, the Tony Ten story about a man who gambled 10 million odd quid and sold whatever it was, a million and three quarters from the local post office to fund his gambling. That's the problem in a gigantic kind of magnifying glass. But it is a huge problem out there. And so in that context, and I mean, look, it's not like he's betting. It's not like he was betting on politics. He was betting on sporting events, and yeah, it was sport that pulled him in, and it was a thrill of getting a result and all that stuff that got him in. So in the context of whether it was a sports book or not, I think it was. I think what really struck me about it, and I read this in one sitting, and I had to get up, I had to put the book down and walk away about four times because it was just so tense. The numbers were swirling, and in a way, The comparison I'd make is with the Eamon McGee book, for example. It's extremely violent. And after a while, you actually get a little bit desensitized to the violence. I mean, you know, if the IRA come and threaten you once, you think, OK, that's enough. But if the IRA are repeatedly threatening you, you kind of suddenly you find yourself going, eh, you know. Whereas with the Tony Ten book, I found with the betting, that didn't happen to me. I was almost sinking lower and lower with him as he was betting. And to me, that's a tribute to the writer.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I find dispiriting about, and we try to avoid it wherever possible in this programme, we may not always succeed, but we've made a conscious effort in recent years, is talking about all predictions, matches and outcome of the odds and stuff like that. Because I don't need to have a bet to enjoy watching sport. I don't have to feel that this need that some people have for involvement is to be betting on the outcome. You can just enjoy a sporting event by watching it for what it is.
Absolutely, yeah. We actually were only having this conversation about this book outside because I had said I picked it up and tried to read it and I had to put it down because I was so, I couldn't understand the amount of money that was being, I couldn't get my head around it. And I was saying that because you're trying to read as many books as possible, I have to wait till I have time to be able to sit down and go through it properly because or Michael have said it, but loads of people have been speaking about how, what a great book it is. And but yeah, look, gambling or betting on games or anything like that, it's not part of, like you say, my family stuff. And I think you find that it's when you're growing up in your family that, you know, that's where it goes and you put odds on. I don't get it. So it's,
but I think in fairness, Declan Lynch, I think actually one of the things that he did, and I don't know whether he thanked me for this, I think he's one of the great Irish writers about addiction. I think that's one of his greatest strengths in writing about people's addictive nature.
And I would go further than that, just from the technical side of things. I mean, you're picking up a book here, right, where you know the major outcome because it's on the front and the back cover. And I mean, I've kind of been in that situation myself with a couple of books where everybody knows the ending of this book. Yeah. So how do you make it suspenseful? And it is a huge tribute to Declan's writing ability that you're able to pick this book up. And at times you actually don't know how this is going to pan out, even though you do. You feel like you don't, and that is the mark of a great book.
Okay, a book I know both of you love, and we had Andy Lee in here recently to talk about it, and Niall Kelly was with him. Niall did a fantastic job with Philly McMahon last year, and he's done another brilliant job, Fighter, with Andy Lee.
Yeah, this was my, you know, Niall should have had a double winner, I think, because after Philly's last year, this was outstanding for me. He captured Andy Lee at the heart. I've the pleasure of meeting Andy a few times, and he's such a gentleman, so humble, and yet can go into a ring and absolutely punch somebody's lights out, to the fact that he's a world champion. And all the stuff, you know, his childhood being a part of the travelling community, and it's just such a really, really well written book that just encapsulates him. And I think it's done in such justice, and it's brilliant. I couldn't put that down. That was by far my favourite book of the year.
Yeah, I mean, two things struck me about it. Number one, Niall Kelly needs to write a book himself. You know, his style of writing is really, really good. And I think Niamh nailed it there, actually, when you said you get to Andy Lee's heart. A lot of people have said, you know, oh, you can hear Andy Lee's voice in this. I don't hear Andy Lee's voice at all because it's far too well written it's not somebody's voice, but it does get to the heart of what he's about and how he thinks and how he works things out. And again, we go back to, you know, books about tragedy and drama and all the rest of it and all that kind of stuff. This is a book that's very much strikes the perfect balance between sport and what's... Now, there are bits and pieces of tragedy in his life, but really it's about an elite individual sportsman working his way through a very difficult professional environment, dealing with relationships and all that kind of stuff. And it's just beautifully
like
put together.
Like,
it's a great read.
Yeah, he had nothing. He went over to America on the back of nothing, basically. And ended up putting in hardship over there, going to England, you know, with boots.
Well, that's the huge thing. I mean, he went to Emmanuel Stewart, who was, of course, a legendary trainer. So he had that to go to Detroit. But I think even greater was when Emmanuel Stewart passed away, he comes back to England, changes weight, yeah, division, changes his entire style of fighting. I would have followed Andy's career, would have written a bit about boxing up the years, and we would have seen this evolving. And it was always, you always just hoped it would work out for him, because he's such, number one, he's such a magnificent technician as a boxer, apart from being just a great guy.
Yeah.
But it's all there in this book, that kind of sense of, and you really want it to work out.
The emotional part of me was like,
you
know? Oh, nice guy's going to win.
I'd say it's also a story that's probably not that well known in Ireland, because he'd spent so much time over in the States.
That's true. Listen, very quickly, we've only got a minute or so left. Quick mention for Paul Rouse's The Hurlers.
The Hurlers, very, very good. It's a story of the first All-Ireland final in 1888. But it's more than that. It's how hurling came to be in terms of GAA. It's excellently put together. It might look a bit tough for people to get into, but it's a great
we have Paul Ayres, a great read. Your pick, Ben Ryan. Who's Ben Ryan? What's his
Ben
book?
Ryan is an English coach that went over to Fiji to coach them to Olympic gold in sevens, and it's just something different. It's called Sevens Heaven, and it's just about the political corruptness over in Fiji, how they all run the rugby over there, the culture. Basically, they were training with no shoes on, like in a field. It was just something so different. Really good read for, like, it doesn't have to be a rugby fan, it can be a sports fan.
All right, I'm going to have to leave it there. Niamh Briggs and Michael Foley, thank you both very much for coming up and joining us here today on The Last Word on Today FM. A listener says, ah, Matt, seriously, you're just adding fuel to the PC fire. Dolly Bird, who could you offend there? A Barbie doll, G.I. Joe, a pigeon? Come on now. I think, Michael, you know, my tongue was stuck firmly in cheek when I admonished you in relation
Dead
to
right.
that.
Dead right.
Thank you both very much.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.